The Tom Woods Show, episode 1927.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. It's 10th or Tuesday on The Tom Woods Show. It's been a long time. It's been like years since I've said that. But Michael, early on, we used to do an occasional 10th or Tuesday where I would have you come on. You, of course, are the executive director and the founder of the 10th Amendment Center. We would talk about what's going on in the world of the 10th Amendment. And then just, I don't know what happened. I let that fall away. But I just love those words, 10th or Tuesday, on the Tom Woods Show. So welcome back.
Tom, every Tuesday is 10th or Tuesday in my heart.
In mine too, my friend.
Nice. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Sure. If only we could insert the violin music here. You know, it's getting all choked up thinking of past 10th or Tuesdays. All right. Well, I'm talking to you today because you reached a very significant milestone recently. You were making public note of the fact that it had been 15 years ago that you registered the domain 10thamendmentcenter.com. So you've been up to this for quite a while. From 2006 to now, you have the great built-in response. If anybody says, oh, well, where were you under George W. Bush when all these things were going on? The answer was, well, I was busy founding the 10th Amendment Center, if you don't mind. So let's talk about this. Obviously, the 10th Amendment Center has evolved. You do different things. Mm-hmm. How's the 10th Amendment Center different in 2021 after the experiences and learning you've done over the past 15 years?
We're incredibly better at what we do. Honestly, I think so. I mean, the message is really the same. We focus using the Constitution as a line in the sand. We try to teach people what that means in practice. And then we also try to teach them and show by example how to defend that line in the sand, whether or not the central government wants us to. I mean, we live under the largest, most powerful government in the history of the planet. We can't rely on Washington, D.C. to limit its own power. That's just not going to work. And most people actually treat things like that. They either want to vote bums out or hope that federal judges are going to limit federal power, but it doesn't work. And no matter what side is in power, that power always grows. So we use the insight of the great father of the American Revolution, Samuel Adams, who wrote, I think it was October 1771, that the truth is all might be free if they valued freedom and defended it as they ought. It's really a 1-2 punch. So people have to not only understand what freedom and liberty is all about, they have to value it, but then they also have to learn how to defend it. And for us, that means not relying on the government to limit itself. And we've gotten far better strategically on that latter part over the years.
Okay, so if you've gotten better at it, that means you weren't as good before. What kind of strategic mistakes would you say you made?
Once we started using the principles of Thomas Jefferson, for example, in his original draft for the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, he told us that in cases of an abuse of the delegated powers, that is, you know, when they're just using bad policy, but they're still within the confines of the Constitution, you should vote the bums out. But where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. Jefferson didn't actually give us a step-by-step prescription on how to get to nullification. So it was kind of up to us to try to apply this in practice. And we would oftentimes get some small victories, for example, against the National Defense Authorization Act. We encouraged and actually successfully got a handful of states and localities to stop participating in that particular indefinite detention provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. But then we would overstate the actual impact in practice, because this is really just a small step forward. And we weren't really good at actually explaining to people what needed to happen next. This is just a first step. And the other thing that we were actually pretty bad on early on, I think, was drafting model legislation. Now, maybe in 15 years, I'm going to look back on this today and say, oh, man, we really sucked in 2021. 2001. But early on, around 2010, 2011, we started putting together our own model legislation for states and eventually localities on things like the Affordable Care Act or to nullify federal gun control in practice and effect. And I looked back at actually our original model legislation on the right to keep and bear arms just a couple of months ago, and I did a podcast about it. And I'm like, man, this is garbage. If someone actually introduced this legislation today, I would say it would have no impact in reality. But over the years, us and a number of other people have all collaborated and improved this stuff. And just this year, we've seen for the first time now, really, five different states have passed legislation to take steps against federal gun control without relying on the feds. Missouri, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, got the Second Amendment Preservation Act signed into law, which would actually ban the state from participating in the enforcement of almost all federal gun control, past, present, and future, something similar in Arizona, and then a few other states as well that are taking smaller steps.
I got a nice note. Is it from Ron Calzone, if I remember his name?
This is an amazing on-the-ground grassroots activist, Ron, without a doubt.
And he was saying, because I guess I went to the Missouri State House and spoke all those years ago.
Yes.
And he thanked me for helping to lay the groundwork for this all these years later. And I had half forgotten I had done it. That's my life's been so eventful. I did do that.
Well, if you think about it, you know, if we're taking that kind of Samuel Adams approach, there are certain people, and we're also thinking, you know, we're thinking about freedom. We also actually understand markets and division of labor. There are some people who are incredibly important and important parts of the puzzle to teach about freedom, to teach the basis. And then there has to be other people who really do the nitty-gritty on-the-ground activism, the concrete steps. And I don't think anyone is actually really kind of capable of trying to do all of it. We try to do a little bit of all of it, but we're far better on the grassroots activism part than I think just on the education. We like to lead by example on a lot of these things. So it makes sense. I mean, how many speeches have you given over the years?
Yeah. One of them was bound to land, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that really did hit because Ron has mentioned that to me over the years a number of times. And we've actually been working on the Second Amendment Preservation Act in Missouri specifically since 2013. So it took 8 tries getting it passed one house, getting it vetoed over and over and over in the face of NRA opposition, in the face of all kinds of opposition. And they finally got it across the finish line this year, and it is in effect as of today.
You know what? Let me ask you something that I have in mind my non-American audience. I think between 15 and 20% of listeners are not Americans. They don't live in the U.S., and I would not expect them to know what the 10th Amendment to the Constitution is. And I bet even a few Americans listening may not know what the 10th Amendment is. So can you just explain it in layman's terms?
Yeah. The federal government is only authorized to do a very limited amount of stuff, and everything else is supposed to be reserved to the states or to the people as the people of each state determine. This is done because if you think about it, you have this large country with a wide range of political, economic, social viewpoints, 300 plus million people. I mean, even at the time of the founding, this was a large landmass with a wide range of views. Someone from Massachusetts probably was far different in their views than someone in Virginia, although people like Samuel Adams and Richard Henry Lee, against all odds, really became great friends over the years. But the only way that you can have these types of viewpoints, a wide range of them living together in peace, is by decentralization. Federalism, the 10th Amendment, the notion that the most difficult, the most divisive issues are going to be determined closer to home as each state or the people of each state determine.
All right, so that's what we're talking about. Now, what about people who say the states themselves sometimes are the problem?
The states are terrible.
Yeah. So is that just outside the bailiwick of the 10th Amendment Center?
No. The states are absolutely terrible. A lot of times, the reason that the states are so terrible is if we do the old school follow the money approach, we realize that a lot of the worst programs on a state or a local level are either incentivized or directly funded by the federal government. the National Governors Association back in one of these fake shutdowns. I think it was the 2013 one where they really don't shut down the warfare state or the surveillance state or their gun control, all the other stuff. They just close a couple of parks and they claim it's some kind of an emergency that we're all going to die. But back in one of these, the National Governors Association put out a press release. They were alarmed about what's going to happen. And they said specifically, states are partners with the federal government on most federal programs. Well, of course, the dirty little secret that supporters of the monster state don't want any of us to know is that partnerships don't work too well when half the team quits. And although the states, every state really, if we're talking about a liberty standard, they're terrible. They're just some are worse on one issue than another, some may be worse overall. I'm not really one to grade on a curve. So they're all bad, but when you localize it or you take it to a smaller geographic region, you can oftentimes find that you can find some spineless, nasty politician who will be happy to blow with the wind. And if your area happens to be on board with banning facial recognition, then maybe they'll be on board with that. Or if your area happens to be on board with banning enforcement of federal gun control, you have a chance. The best example I can think of is if we go back to the bankster bailouts during the Bush administration. From my understanding, there were thousands and thousands of phone calls to the White House switchboard on this. And it was like 90 to 95% against, but they went with it anyways. But I've heard over the years, especially in some of the smaller jurisdictions, that 10 to 15 personal phone calls to a state legislator, for example, in some judiciary committee or something like that, can get them to consider the legislation and at least give it a hearing. So I think when you're closer to the individual, you have a greater chance of actually advancing liberty, even though I would still say all politicians are really pretty much the bad guy. Well, all is probably too complete. Close to all.
I was going to ask you, 15 years of running the 10th Amendment Center, if anything has surprised you, because to me, the thing that has surprised me, even though you'd think, given the unfortunate cynical streak that I have, that it shouldn't have surprised me, is how few people are principled enough to consistently support a 10th Amendment Center. When what tends to happen is, if it's my issue or my guy in there, then I'll let the federal government do more or less what it wants. But then we'll come crawling back when the other guy is in power. I guess I thought there were more people out there who just in general always believed in decentralization.
I have a different surprise. When I started the organization, and I actually registered a couple of other domain names at the time, Fourth Amendment Center, Fifth Amendment Center, and 10th Amendment Center. No third, no ninth, but you know, you can only do so much. I'm glad that there's just the one left because I spend all day, every day, oftentimes 7 days a week working on just the 10th. But what I'm actually most surprised thinking back on this was when I started this as a one-person blog, my goal really was just to reach one, maybe two people with the idea that no matter what they do, they probably aren't authorized to do it. And if they are, it probably costs way more than they promised in the first place, or there's some unintended consequence. What I'm most surprised at is there's actually a movement that's grown up around this. And yes, a lot of it is based on partisan garbage, like you're describing, Tom. And I used to think of that in a cynical way myself, like, oh, these people are just losers. Like, they were totally against, this guy bombing this country, and saying there's no constitutional authorization for that. But now their dude's in charge and they're totally okay with it and back and forth and back and forth. But instead, we've actually just acknowledged that that's the way things are for most people. So we've tried to leverage that. And I think because of that, we've been more successful this year now that the current president is there instead of the previous NRA-backed guy on getting states to reject federal gun control, because we're just kind of playing into that and we're trying to get some wins on the board. And I think the more that we show people that the world doesn't come to an end when this happens, the more we're going to see it play out on more issues. I mean, we've got 36 states, 18 with full legal and another 18 with medical on a plant 15 years ago. And I would talk to a red state or a group of Republicans, well, probably more like 12 years ago when I would do this. They would basically want to run me out on a rail, throw me out of the room, but I would keep pushing the message forward. And I think now, because they've learned by example, the world didn't come to an end because people can grow a plant and buy and sell it. then we have to do the same thing on the right to keep and bear arms, on healthcare, and all kinds of other stuff. I know the Mises Institute just did an event up in New Hampshire on health freedom, and they were talking about direct primary care. And this is something we support as well, not in a huge way, but we get behind this state-level type of a legislation where it actually creates, in state law, direct primary care, where you have kind of Netflix or some kind of subscription model for medical care. You could pay one flat monthly fee for general care. This is outside the onerous state regulations under the insurance code. And this advances some freedom, and it creates an environment where I think it's more difficult for the central government to control it as well. I think we just need to see more and more of that. I know you interviewed, who was the person from Oklahoma Surgery Center some years ago as well?
Keith Smith.
Yeah, that's really important stuff to do. We have to actually, every time we advance freedom on a local, state, or an individual level, I think we have some impact on a larger scale as well.
Now, looking back over 15 years, what would you say you're the proudest of? You're not the boastful sort, so this is a tricky question, but what are you the proudest of?
I got nothing.
What?
I mean,
do I have to start naming things that you need to be proud of? This is terrible.
I know we've done a lot of awesome things, but I always think, and I go back to Thomas Jefferson writing to his friend, the Reverend Charles Clay in 1790, and he said,
I always go back to that, Michael. Always Reverend Charles Clay letter. All right, what does it say?
The ground of liberty is to be gained by inches.
Oh,
and okay. I think that no matter how many inches we've gained, and we've done a lot of them over the years, there's still way more to go. We still live under the largest government in the history of the world. And I think brick by brick, we're just setting the foundation for a better future.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Let me ask you something more meta about running an organization.
Okay.
Because you used to do conferences.
Yes.
For several years, you ran a lot of them, the Nullify Now tour, and I was at most of them and spoke at them, and there's YouTube evidence of this. And boy, those old speeches, Michael, have bailed me out many a time when I've needed a day off from the Tom Woods Show. I have a huge archive of talks from your conferences. And then you decided for one reason or another that this wasn't the way you wanted to spend your time, or wasn't strategically the best way to use your limited resources. So what I wonder is, how does an organization like yours, that although you do get some big media coverage from time to time when there are certain hot issues on everybody's minds, you're not the Heritage Foundation.
No.
You don't get shout outs from Sean Hannity or anybody like that. I would think, or I would at least be willing to test whether having conferences was nevertheless, even despite the expense and the pain in the neck, it's a way of getting out to the public that you exist. And maybe you draw in donors from that. How, apart from holding conferences, apart from all the work you have to do doing the work of the 10th Amendment Center, how do you publicize the existence of the 10th Amendment Center such that you're able to attract enough donors to keep the thing going?
You ready? This is fun. So, on the one hand, it's about content. We're basically like a media organization. Well, there's over 10,000 articles, blogs, podcasts. I mean, not as many podcasts and stuff, videos. Over 10,000 on the 10thAmendmentCenter.com website. And when I'm really clocking, really working at my best, I'm posting over social media platforms somewhere between 50 and 75 pieces of content per day. So we are blasting like crazy. We certainly could reach different audiences by doing in-person events, but really it gets down to a resources issue. And we've been able to actually do that. One of my previous careers was as a nightclub promoter some years ago. So I'm well-versed in promotion and putting together events and things like that. Sometimes they're a little kind of by the seat of my pants, but this is something that I've known for many years, and I just translated that into the work that I do now. But it certainly is very, very resource intensive, and from manpower, person power, and cost. So we've just really kind of restructured to focus primarily online.
I understand that completely. I have not very often tried to run events. Even my 1,000th episode, I had an event planner doing it, because I think I would have lost my mind, because there's so many moving parts. I think I would have just had a nervous breakdown. I don't want to do that. So that's another factor.
Think about it, though. 10th Amendment Center is basically the original Tom Woods bump. And if you're talking about, for real, I mean, I know you remember personally, but maybe others listening don't, but up until around 2012, 2013, and I started the organization in 2006, it was basically every few weeks to few months, I was sending out an email and telling people, man, I really want to keep this going, but unless I get some funding, this isn't going to happen.
I remember that.
Absolutely. And part of the reason that I got myself in that bind is I overextended by doing events, publishing content, trying to do activism, trying to do too much at the same time. And you, sometime early, mid-2013, you put out a call to everyone that you knew, basically through email and some social posts, saying, you got to help these guys. And from that point forward, I never, ever looked back. We kind of narrowed down our focus because you helped generate a lot of donations that time and probably every single time since. But this was the original, in my mind, the original Tom Woods bump that I experienced. It basically was a life raft. We were sinking because we were trying to do too much. Once we had the cash on hand, we focused and we created a leaner, meaner, more effective machine here at TAC.
I don't suppose you would know this offhand. You'd have to look it up. I don't remember how many years it's been that I've been supporting the 10th Amendment Center with a monthly contribution.
A long time.
It's been a while. It's been a while. And then I recently increased the amount to... I'll just say the 10th Amendment Center is, I give more to you per month than I give to anybody else.
And it is the most that anyone donates to TAC on a monthly basis. It's close, but it is number one.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
You are number one on a monthly basis.
Okay. Now I realize that means I have got a little bit of clout around the 10th Amendment Center.
Yeah, I mean,
if there's any corruption, which I hope there is.
I know I got that kind of idea, hey, Bolden, why don't you work on this thing? And I'm like, well, I'm pretty easily purchased. So
that's funny. All right. Well, before we go on, I'll say, obviously, I want people to support the 10th Amendment Center. What you do on a shoestring is incredible. And the way you have inserted our ideas into the discussion in state after state after state and had results that we can all see. We don't have to think, well, we've got some ideas circulating, and so maybe 20 years from now, they'll germinate in somebody's mind. No, it's you won that victory in that state. And you are the person the legislators turn to when they wanted advice as to how to frame an issue and what to do. What you're doing is so important. And as I say, as with anybody who is a dissident voice, you're not going to be featured prominently and, let's say, favorably in mainstream right. outlets. So you need our friends to come together, recognize the value of what you're doing, and make it happen. So 10thamendmentcenter.com is the website. You'll see a donate button there. I want to ask you about some things that you and I encountered over the years in our own separate attempts to promote these ideas. And one was that sometimes our critics were not the predictable critics. Like, I know that if we pass this kind of bill through the Missouri State House, I know the kind of people who are going to hate that bill.
Right.
But on the other hand, sometimes the people who were unhappy with you would be the Heritage Foundation, would be right of center think tanks. Because in theory, of course, they claim to like the Constitution. Oh, so they like the 10th Amendment well enough. But if you actually want to give teeth to the 10th Amendment, now, Michael Bolden, you're not supposed to do that. If the federal government goes beyond its delegated powers, you're supposed to just sit there and take it like the good loser that you are. You're not supposed to fight back. So can you comment on that?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of them. In fact, if we're talking about Missouri or the Arizona Second Amendment Preservation Act that was signed into law this year as well, the number one opposition we've gotten on protecting using the 10th Amendment to protect the Second Amendment is from the NRA. It has always been from the NRA. Maybe not as much this year as it was 3 or 4 years ago. Now, it's law enforcement lobby organizations who love tying federal gun control to the federal war on drugs and asset forfeiture. So they've lobbied aggressively against this in places like Missouri, in Wyoming, Montana, and almost anywhere we push this type of legislation. But we have to keep pushing through anyways. And sometimes it's like the moms demand action type are really taking a back seat to the friendly fire, puns are all intended here, that we're getting from the right to keep and bear arms community. But then we also had attacks, like you said, from The Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute some years ago, didn't like our approach on nullification. You just can't do this. We've been called the ACLU wing of the Tea Party in the Wall Street Journal editorial page. We had two former Bush administration officials say that we're fear-mongering about indefinite detention. And one of those guys who did that was Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer on the Padilla torture case, the Jose Padilla torture case. So, I mean, yeah, we get attacked from the left and the right. And I think, as Lou Rockwell told me some years ago after Rachel Maddow did a full 10-minute segment attacking our work as neo-Confederate and evil and trying to bring down the entire country, he said it was a badge of honor. And to me, that was, man, I will never forget that.
Hey, folks, let's take a break to thank our amazing sponsor, We the People Holsters. I mean, come on now. I know you guys are all Second Amendment people. I know you're all gun guys out there. Old Woods here has a We the People holster, and so should you. We the People holsters are 100% American-made and custom-modeled to fit your exact firearm for a quick, smooth draw. And with thousands of options to choose from, plus a selection of custom-printed holsters, you're sure to find just the right fit for your lifestyle. Plus, their proprietary clip allows you to customize the cant and ride for comfortable fit you can wear all day. But that's not all. Check out their complete line of patriotic shirts, their 100% American-made tactical gun belt with a proprietary Talon buckle and premium line of bacon jerky. Yes, you heard that right. Bacon jerky made from 100% American patriotic pigs. So show your support for the Tom Woods Show and this great American company. Go to wethepeopleholsters.com/woods right now and take an additional $10 off with offer code WOODS10. That's wethepeopleholsters.com/woods, wethepeopleholsters.com/woods. I always appreciate friends of mine who help me think things through when times get tough like that, but I don't know, maybe I'm just a softie or something, but attacks like that do bother me sometimes because I don't like it when total strangers who have never met me or read anything I've written have already formed an inaccurate view of me, that they already think of me as a bad guy when it seems to me I'm pretty clearly the good guy in this story.
Yeah, I think it really, so like Maddow, for example, her and then the Maddow blog that they've run for so many years, they've nailed us a bunch of times over the years and they never reach out, never. Everybody else, LA Times, New York Times, Reuters, US News, anybody else who wants to say something poorly about the 10th Amendment Center, nullification, any of our work, liberty, whatever, they at least reach out to us. Even the Southern Poverty Law Center reached out to me before they published my full profile as part of their Hate Watch Leaders of the Radical Right publication some years ago. They even reached out to me. I refused to talk to them. But everybody else has at least contacted us. Maddow, for example, I don't know. I guess they just don't like honesty.
They really are the worst. The way they've treated the nullification issue, it's all just fifth grade talking points, as if we've never heard them before. It's like somebody coming up to you and saying, we need to flatten the curve. Flatten the curve means we're going to push down the number... Okay, it's literally impossible for me not to know what flattening the curve is. Okay, so for you to come over to me and think that that's some kind of an argument when it's just the conventional wisdom that I've obviously heard. I've obviously heard all the fifth grade level arguments against state nullification. I've obviously heard them. What do you think my response is? Have you ever bothered to consider that? Well, the question answers itself. I think what's going on in part, I think two things are happening when the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation... By the way, that did not surprise me. Yeah. It surprised some people. I was surprised that people were surprised.
Yeah.
Did you really think that the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation were all about, you know, taking action of a sort that the New York Times doesn't approve of? Do you actually think that they want us to abandon the rule book?
Yeah, I mean, Cato has actually been the least bad on this, but they did jump in on us a few years ago as well. I think it was Robert Levy, one of the top guys there. And we've had good relationships with individuals, and I'm sure just like you.
Yes, just like I have. Yes.
Yes. Same type of a scenario. But I think as a big picture and organizational structure, it's really what you're talking about here. Because whether it's left or right or some version of that, they really thrive off the status quo. That is, everything bad was caused by this side, and we just need to be in power so this side doesn't do any more bad stuff anymore. And I think that's the message that we basically get from Heritage Foundation for so many years. Because years ago, we saw even publications in Human Events, where you, I know you've published articles as well on nullification, at least one you had posted at Human Events. But they were basically saying, don't use nullification because it is dangerous. Instead, do this, this, this. In other words, vote in the Tea Party and then go to court and then vote for Romney and then go to court and then vote for this guy and then go to court. And you know what's been dangerous? Relying on the federal government to limit its own power, or hoping that new bums are going to say to all that power that's right in front of them, no thanks, I'll limit it. That's been more dangerous than anything we've ever proposed about following the founders' advice from James Iredell to Thomas Jefferson and everybody in between. That is to resist the federal government when it usurps or exercises powers never delegated to them in the first place.
So it's two things then. It is a style thing. It's just not their style to go to go off script, so to speak, and to do something like nullification that, I'm sorry to keep saying this, but the New York Times has not approved this strategy. They do approve the strategy of waiting for judges to support you. I guess we'll do that. Well, some of us are a little bit more impatient for that. But the other thing is, their strategy is more of, instead of a bottom-up strategy where from one state at a time is going to try to figure out what the right thing to do is, it's a top-down liberty strategy. If we could just get good federal judges in power, then they'll impose liberty on the society from the top. So we won't need messy solutions like nullification. But in practice, that doesn't seem to work out. I was just thinking about Angel Raich's Supreme Court case back in, what was
2005.
It? 15, 16 years ago. Now, in that case, I bet people would have been told, well, you have some left-leaning justices on there. Maybe you have a chance of, or this was a medical marijuana case, maybe you have a chance of that being successful for her and for the cause. And instead, the only decent justice on that was Clarence Thomas.
Right.
The left-leaning ones, their view, which is exactly the view that you would get from Ian Millhiser and all the thought controllers on the official left-wing legal blogs, was that federal law must be upheld regardless of whether it makes any sense or the justice involved. Federal law must be upheld. That was what the Supreme Court said. It was only Clarence Thomas saying, the arguments you're making to explain to me how medical marijuana grown in one finite place for the immediate use of the user has anything to do with interstate commerce, this is ridiculous. I mean, yeah, ridiculous.
Thomas basically said, and this was the majority opinion was written by the conservative Scalia.
Yeah.
Where he said, like, and Thomas said, I'm paraphrasing, if the federal government can look at six plants grown in one's backyard, never bought or sold, never taken across state line, and consumed in someone's home, their commerce powers are unlimited. And I think he was absolutely correct, because they use that same reasoning. The Obama administration used that same reasoning from Scalia in the Obamacare case, the NFIB versus Sebelius, some years later in 2012. So this is a precedent. Every time you allow a precedent, allow them to have power because it fits one's political goals, which both left and right do. The establishment on both sides certainly do that all the time. Eventually, someone else is going to have that power in the future. It's the late, great Harry Brown's warning. Every power you give to government to do something you like today is going to be in the hands of someone that you don't like in the future.
Now, incidentally, it's possible that occasionally a federal judge might do the right thing. I'm not saying that that's impossible.
Once in a while.
Yeah. But I am saying that it's sort of a forlorn hope to think that that could ever be the entirety of your approach.
It's a numbers game. It's a numbers game. I think the Supreme Court gets somewhere between 10 and 20,000 requests per year. They take somewhere between 80 and 120 cases per year. And then maybe they strike down or overturn or have an opinion that says it's unconstitutional on maybe two or three. So if we're talking about the largest, most powerful government and empire in the history of the world, if we're talking about having to go through all of these numbers, we're all going to be long dead and gone before there's any liberty. This is not the best strategy going forward. Of course, the people, we want to hit them from every angle possible. So people who are good lawyers, who want to do that, they certainly should, and we should encourage and support them. But we should not put all of our eggs in one basket. And in fact, even James Madison in Federalist 48 specifically told us that literally putting a mere demarcation on parchment, words on paper, and relying on the government to enforce those own limits on itself is not enough to actually stop what would end up being a concentration of powers in one body. So too much centralization of power happens when you rely on the government to read its own ruling document and interpret it the way it wants to.
Well, as we wrap up here, I could make my usual appeal that the work you do is so important. You've gotten these ideas. And by the way, these are Thomas Jefferson's ideas. These are not ideas that Michael Bolden thought up. You're a clever guy. Maybe you could have thought them up. But no. It's more important that the ideas that you're putting forth here are more than 200 years old. And they do come from Thomas Jefferson. And I always just want people who are vocally against us just to have the guts to come out and admit, yep, these are Thomas Jefferson's ideas. And I just think Jefferson went way wrong on them. They never do that. Because even now, even in this cancel world, Thomas Jefferson, that name still holds an awful lot of, I don't know, prestige or respect. Yeah. They can't say that name. They'll say John C. Calhoun, but they can't say Jefferson. So I always hit them with Jefferson, 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 as you did in this very episode, which I just love. That is exactly how we should handle it. But you've taken these ideas and made it possible for liberty-minded state legislators all over the place to run with them. And people of all different points of view have come on board with the 10th Amendment Center at one time or another because there's one particular issue maybe that they believe in strongly, and maybe they don't like some of the other issues. But if they're good on that one issue, the 10th Amendment Center will stand with them and try to restore self-government and local control over that one issue. So as we wrap up, can you describe for us maybe what's on the agenda right now for the 10th Amendment Center? What kinds of issues are you looking at?
Oh man, we're doing anything and everything we can possible. Of course, the right to keep and bear arms. We work on police state issues like asset forfeiture, federal militarization, no-knock warrants, surveillance from NSA spying to local facial recognition. Anything and everything in between. We use James Madison, Thomas Jefferson's advice, which has actually been surprisingly backed up by the Supreme Court in the anti-commandeering doctrine, that the federal government can't require the states to help the federal government implement or enforce its federal acts or regulatory programs. So we just say, let's take a kind of a Rosa Parks approach on this. Hands off, on a state level, we won't participate in all of these things or one of them, and we keep pushing forward. So we're putting together an updated edition over the summer of our State of the Nullification Movement report. That'll be out sometime in August or so. And then Mike Meharry, actually, who I know you've hung out with a bunch of times over the years, Tom, he actually just finished up this really great new ebook called The National Bank Versus the Constitution. And he's tying the Federal Reserve System of today with Alexander Hamilton's vision for the first bank of the U.S., making the case that if you understand the arguments of Jefferson, Madison, and others against that, you've got the constitutional arguments against most of the monster state today. So a lot of education in the summertime, and then in the fall and through the spring, we do a lot of state-level legislation and activism.
That is tremendous to hear. Mike has been a guest on the Tom Woods Show, I'm happy to say, and you're right, I've had a chance to see him more because he lives in Florida and you're all the way at the other end of the country, although I did enjoy seeing you in May with my daughter, Elizabeth.
That was awesome.
So wonderful. You and Sarah are so wonderful with children. And she wanted you to spend more of the week with us. Can they come on the
really
boat ride with us? It was really, really great. So thanks to both of you for that. But also just, again, for doing what you've been doing and in particular for getting through that rough time when it just seemed like, doggone it, people, you have got to step up and support me here if I'm going to make this thing, you know, work. And you did, and they did. But there's always more that can be done. So I'm going to urge people to join me. And apparently, I'm the biggest monthly donor there is. So at least I'm telling you to do something that I myself am doing. This is not a do as I say, not as I do. This is a do as I say and as I do. So 10thamendmentcenter.com. I'm sure it's 10thamendmentcenter.com/donate.
It is.
But check out 10thamendmentcenter.com. You're absolutely going to love it. And it's run by a really, really good guy. Not one of these, we have so many grifters. in the constitutionalist movement who are going to talk to you all day.
That's an understatement, man.
They're going to talk to you all day long about the Constitution, but none of it's going to ever amount to a hill of beans. But you are taking this knowledge and turning it into real live action that we can see before our eyes. And so we are grateful to you for that, Michael Bolden. I'll put the link up at tomwoods.com/1927. And I am looking forward to seeing you as one of my special guests at the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show in October of this year.
My favorite event ever was the 1000th, so no pressure, but you really got to ramp it up to beat that one.
It is so ramped up. We are going to slaughter that event. My only regret is that Dave Smith can't be there this time, and that's because he's having a baby at that exact time.
I mean, have we talked to him about that? Like, can he reschedule?
Well, I was thinking, I mean, really, that was pretty low to decide that was the time to do that, knowing full well that he can do math. That right. 9 months later, that means the Tom Woods Show 2000 episode is
weeks.
Out. But no, but anyway, that's okay. That's okay. That just will make the roast of Dave Smith at the 3000th episode all the sweeter, my friend, all the sweeter. So anyway, thanks again, Michael. I'm speaking for everybody. We love and appreciate what you do.
I can't thank you enough, Tom. This has been a real great time on this show, and I'm so grateful for your friendship and support over the years.
All right, folks, do support the 10th Amendment Center. And of course, come see Michael Bolden along with me and with a great many other favorite guests from the Tom Woods Show at the 2000th episode event that I'm having in Orlando, October 16th of this year, 2021. Get the details on how to register. It doesn't cost you a thing to attend, but you do need to register at tomwoods2000.com. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.